Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Fourth Dimension and Four Perspectives, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
Understandings gained from the fourth dimension tend to make one a good teacher and philosopher. Yet it is not powerful like the fifth dimension, but serene and quiet. It gives the experience of a pure state of awareness flowing through the mind and is the threshold to vaster inner space and spiritual realization. From the fourth dimension, one has here and now consciousness and is able to perceive a scope of 9 days at once. Whereas from the third dimension, one sees basically the pattern of the current day, and from the second, a span of only a few minutes or hours. This 9-day time period looks from now into the past and ahead to the future, approximately 4.5 days or 108 hours in both directions. That is the reason that we can make accurate and valid judgments from the discriminating consciousness of the fourth dimension, for it sees the totality of intermingled past actions and future effects from a mountaintop perspective. It is easier to maintain the overview of the fourth dimension as it looks into and through the second and third if we practice containing awareness within the boundaries of the 9-day period. Not speaking or thinking unnecessarily about events or experiences that are more than 4.5 days in the past or 4.5 days in the future. Awareness can then concentrate on current happenings, bringing the aspirant into the intuitively inspired consciousness of being here and now, not there and then, or even where and when. From this vantage point, we can view the building of emotional involvements within the third dimension, observing the workings of the emotional and intellectual units of ourselves and others. From this detachment, we gain the ability to dissolve confusions, conflicts, and the various and varied entanglements that are encountered daily. And, if they are merely seen, that in itself is the necessary elucidation, for congestion cannot exist when perceived with clarity. Also from the fourth dimension, we have the choice as to the kinds of third dimensional creations we involve awareness in. We see precisely the path ahead and are able to avoid undesirable areas and karmic sidetracks. Thus, by clearing congestion at the time it is generated without letting it settle and in a sense harden in subconscious memory cells, and by holding the overview as to the optimum course of action based on a cognition of past and future, awareness is kept free-flowing in the spiritual intensity of now. When we can hold ourselves in consciousness steady enough to see yesterday and tomorrow right in the same moment, we are in the fourth dimension. When we can hold ourselves steady enough to see the flow of force and vibration in the inner atmosphere between other people and ourselves, we are in the fourth dimension. It is not as difficult as we sometimes make it seem to be in the fourth dimension. Most people spend quite a bit of their time in the fourth dimensional realm without even realizing it. But the discovery of the fourth dimension, or any dimension, is the discovery that we're already there, and knowing when we are there and when we are not there. If we know that, we automatically know how to be there when we find we are not. When we are emotionally tangled or upset, and we see that we are emotionally upset, we're in the fourth dimension. The fourth dimension is the watcher. If totally enmeshed in the third dimension, we would be upset, but would be too identified with the emotion to be able to simultaneously observe, I am upset. I feel confused and terrible. When we watch the mind think, we are using a faculty of the fourth dimension. Only the fourth dimension can observe the thinking process at work. That is a good, clear way to look at the fourth dimension as simply the watcher, the witness. There are millions of different ways consciousness can and does function in the fourth dimension, but this is the best way to define and learn of it. It is the home base for the Yani. He never moves further out in consciousness than the fourth dimension, never becomes attached or identified with thought, emotion, or even the multitudinous forms of superconsciousness. He is the watcher, and his awareness is centered, hovering like a hummingbird, governing the flow of the externalities of life, while resting in the peace and enlightenment of its own being. From his established silent center, he looks at and into every aspect of the interrelated states of mind, the interrelated states of the nervous system, as seen by the fourth dimension. Awareness remains basically within the fourth dimension and does not have to flow out into the second or third, because the visionary powers and faculty of inner sight already sees out through the third and second dimensions, acts and governs those dimensions, as well as the personality effectively from the fourth without ever leaving it. The actinodic body referred to, is a body of light. It is also called the astral body. It is not a highly spiritual body. It is just a duplicate of the physical body and exists inside of the physical in the third dimension plane. The astral plane is exact duplicate of this plane, but when you are looking into it from the fourth dimension, you see what is going to happen 3 or 4 days ahead of time. You are actually seeing events happening on the astral plane that will take place 3 or 4 days from now on this plane. Physical plane creations happen first on the astral plane, which is always 72 hours ahead of this plane. When in the fourth dimension, you are out of the time-space continuum as we generally know it. It's all there. You don't travel in the fourth dimension. You're there. Things just appear. Around 2 o'clock each morning, when the inner plane schools take place and students gather in the fourth dimension, if I'm awake, I can close my eyes and they inwardly appear in my mind. I can identify many of them one after another. Even devotees whom I haven't thought of in 8 or 9 years still attend inwardly. They are there. In a body that looks like a mannequin made out of clear plastic. It's not a fleshy body, it's a light body that glows of itself. I can see all of their features as one appears and then disappears, so the next one comes forward. So they can come right into the mind, come to learn of the within, the inner worlds. The fourth dimension is the natural state of mankind, the state he resides in unless external events consume awareness. In some thinking, it is the state of the soul. Whereas man himself creates the third dimension in daily life, the fourth dimension is the being of man and how he relates to himself within himself. Living here, he is peaceful, alive, and balanced. Consciousness never sleeps. Mystics leave their physical body at night in a state of sleep and go into the fourth dimension in consciousness and continue a very lively mental life, teaching and being taught within the recesses of this and deeper dimensions. This is especially true if they practice the conscious withdrawal of awareness from the body and from the vibratory patterns of the day just before they go to sleep. The fourth dimension does not always remain the same. Consciousness within it changes the flow of currents that run through that dimension, just as they do in the third. However, the patterns within the fourth are fairly well set, more regimented, so to speak, whereas third-dimensional patterns fluctuate and change. Consciousness, then, takes a different perspective or a different way of looking at it. The fourth dimension is already well known by everyone on the path, otherwise they would not even know that there is a path to be on. It does not take years of difficult practice to break into and experience it. It's very simple. There's no practice involved. That was done while we were evolving. That was the practice. The many lives of evolution, that was the rehearsal. Now we can enjoy it. The fourth dimension merges into the fifth, and at that point it is really impossible to distinguish the two. But the fourth flows and functions through the subconscious faculties and can therefore observe the third. The fifth dimension cannot. That is the reason the fourth dimension encompasses the sub-superconscious, the intuitive realm of consciousness. The fifth dimension doesn't contact the third. It cuts right through it. So, very interesting ideas. As you can see, it's not edited. One of the reasons I stumbled a few times. But it's very interesting material. It's some 36, 37 years old on the fourth dimension. So Gurudeva's idea is he's defined seven dimensions of the mind, and when we understand them, it's a very helpful concept in our meditation. We have some idea where we are and some idea where we're going. And that gets part of the whole idea of the Shum Chaif language, is to try and give us a map for our meditation, try and give us a sense of what's where and how to get from one place to another. So recognizing where we are is part of it, and then understanding how to go somewhere else and then actually getting there is how it all works. So the concept of the seven dimensions in that regard is a useful tool, but beyond that, of course, we have to understand certain concepts within each dimension, like the simple concept here of feeling the spiritual energy of the spine, which is called Simshum Bisi. Feeling the actinic energy of the spine is one of the basic practices, and other basic practices are similar to that, and by doing them we can go within ourselves as well as move from a dimension that's not that deep into one that's much deeper by certain practices. So we, as most of you know, we have three of our monks are on pilgrimage in India, departed December 5th. A little over 3 weeks. So they're right now, they're in Karakudi area, heading for Tanjavur and then for Chidambaram. Gonna have a 3-day stay at Chidambaram very soon, and they timed it so that they're there for the major festival day of the year, Ardra Darshanam, which is January 3rd in India, or January 2nd here. And, the most important day for Nataraja of the year. So in our own temple, we have 12 ceremonies, one a month on the Ardra Nakshatra, but this one, the one in the month of December 15th to January 15th, is the most important one. So that's January 2nd. Any of you who are here on January 2nd, that's our 9 a.m. puja on January 2nd. It's the major one of the year. So I was thinking about Shiva temples, and in the daily Master Course lesson from Gurudeva, there's been a couple of lessons about the Shiva temple recently. I thought I'd read and then comment on. Sloka 101 from Dancing with Shiva. What is the nature of the Shiva temple? The Shiva temple is the abode of God Shiva and gods, and the precinct in which the three worlds consciously commune. It is specially sanctified, possessing a ray of spiritual energy connecting it to the celestial worlds. Bhasya. The three pillars of Saivism are the temples, the scriptures, and the Satgurus. These we revere, for they sustain and preserve the ancient wisdom. Shiva temples, whether they be small village sanctuaries or towering citadels, are esteemed as God's home and consecrated abode. In the Shiva temple, we draw close to God Shiva and find a refuge from the world. His grace permeating everywhere is most easily known within the precincts of the Shiva temple. It is in the purified milieu of the temple that the three worlds can commune most perfectly, that devotees can establish harmony with inner plane spiritual beings. When the spiritual energy, Shakti, invoked by the puja permeates the sanctum sanctorum and floods out to the world, Sarvites know they are in a most holy place where God and the gods commune with them. Within most Shiva temples are private rooms, sanctums for Lord Ganesha and Lord Kartikeya, and shrines for the many gods and saints. The Vedas explain, even as the radiance of the sun enlightens all regions, above, below, and slantwise, so that only God, glorious and worthy of worship, rules over all his creation. Om Namah Shivaya. One more. How are Shiva temples founded and built? Sloka 102. Shiva temples are founded by God himself, often designated in a vision or a dream of a devout Saivite, then erected by temple craftsmen, usually following Agamic law. In such a holy place, holiness itself can reside. Because of its holiness, a Shiva temple is most often and properly established by God Shiva through his devotees and not founded by men. Once the site is known, hereditary temple architects known as sthapatis are commissioned to design and construct the temple. By tradition, every stone is set in place according to the sacred architecture found in the Agamic scriptures. When properly consecrated, the temple becomes a place upon the earth in which the three worlds can communicate for the upliftment of mankind and the fulfillment of Shiva's dharmic law. Shiva has deliberately established many temples to communicate his love to his children throughout the world, who live in every country of the world and long for their Lord's ever-present love. They build temples in his name and install his image, chant his praises, and thus invoke his presence. Lord Shiva accepts all these temples as his own and sends a divine ray to vivify and vitalize them. Shiva's Vedas enunciate, Brahman is the priest, Brahman the sacrifice. By Brahman the posts are erected. From Brahman the officiating priest was born. In Brahman is concealed the oblation. Om Namah Shivaya. So I was thinking about that, about visions, and as Gurudeva's lesson says, Shiva temples are most properly founded upon a vision. So when it comes to Chidambaram, the tradition says, Shiva is said to have revealed a vision of his cosmic dance to Patanjali, Vyagrapadar, and to all the devas there. So that's the idea of Chidambaram. It's founded upon the vision of Shiva's dancing to Patanjali and Vyagrapada. The website said something interesting. I didn't realize this. The Devaram hymns were rediscovered here after a long hiatus under the initiative of the monarch Rajaraja Chola. The Chidambaram temple predates the Devaram hymns. The imperial Cholas considered Nataraja to be their tutelary deity and heap patronage on this temple. And their tradition was continued by the Pandyas and the Vijayanagar kings. So I hadn't realized that Cholas and Nataraja were so tightly bound together. So in case of our own Yerevan temple, of course, we have Gurudeva's vision. It took place in, don't tell me, February 15th, 1975. Is that right? 73? February 15th, 1975. Gurudeva had a very powerful vision of Shiva, where we now have our Swayambhu Lingam out there. In the early morning of February 15th, 1975, and ever since that day, we've done puja to the lingam to sustain the vibration, sustain the vision, sustain the hookup to the inner worlds. And recently we've added the sanctum of the nearby Iravan temple to it. So first we do the puja to the Shiva Swayambhu Lingam, and then we come over to the sanctum, of course, which doesn't have an image yet, and we do the puja there. So we're starting to hook the two up. The idea is that we've been sustaining the power of the vision through our simple daily puja now since 1975, and the temple will expand upon it, draw upon that vision, draw upon the power that we've been sustaining since 1975, so 31 some years, when the pujas there start in on a regular basis. So it's a very important vision, and as the text says, Shiva temples are properly founded upon a vision. So to emphasize that, we've decided to start a yearly puja on the day of the vision. So ceremonies are not done on the Western calendar. They're done usually on the nakshatra or sometimes the titi. So the nakshatra is Revati nakshatra. So Revati nakshatra in the month of Kumbha is the day. So that this year we're going to start February 20th. And I have a ceremony out there at 6 a.m. to commemorate Gurudeva's vision, and then start doing that every year. And those of us who were here in 1975, the vision is very much alive in our minds, but many of us weren't here. So we want to impress the fact that this vision happened, and it's the founding vision for the Iravan Temple, which is quite powerful and is written up in Island Temple. If you haven't read it, describes it in detail there. Very special. So we need a good name for that festival. I don't have one at the moment, but one possibility is Parameshwara Anubhava. How's that? Vision of the primal soul. Vision of Shiva as personal God. Parameshwara Anubhava. Possibility? So I've been doing some work in Gurudeva's Shum language, the language of meditation. I thought I'd share some of that. So one of the write-ups that Gurudev has done is on what he calls the four perspectives, or four ways of looking at things in terms of seeking knowledge. So we go through those. We have words in the Shum language for each of those, so we're going through two examples which utilize these perspectives. So the perspective on which the language is based is the Shumif perspective, or Shum perspective. The Shumif perspective is that the mind is a solid, the inner mind, and awareness flows from one area of it to another, as the traveler would travel from one city to another. The cities do not move, the traveler does. The Simnif perspective is that everything is moving in the inner mind with form and things, and that the awareness of the person watching does not move. One is stationary while looking into a microscope and seeing new forms of life. One is stationary when looking into an ocean or lake and seeing schools of fish moving here and there. These two perspectives, Shumif and Simnif, are exactly opposite one from another. The Mulif perspective is a philosophical one, metaphysical, psychological. It is the perspective of some of the religions of the world. It is the perspective that all realization, understanding, is worked out within and among people and their minds. In this perspective, one is unaware of the gods, the three perfections of Lord Shiva, the existence of people on other planets, spacecraft. It is more of a subjective, intellectual perspective as to the nature of the universe, God, and man. Realization is often attained through simply understanding deep philosophical concepts. This would be an intellectual realization, not a spiritual one. The Dimfi perspective is one that acknowledges, understands, and communicates with God and gods, beings on the astral plane, people from other planets. It is here that all psychic phenomena takes place, and the mind is open to all kinds of possibilities of the extraterrestrial, out-of-body experiences, etc. Here, reincarnation is understood. The two perspectives, Mulif and Dimfi, are exactly opposite. These four perspectives of consciousness are complete within themselves. Each one has its obvious limitations. Yet each one is an area that people are caught up in and unable to move out of. There is a fifth perspective, Dinamif, one spiritually unfolds into, of being able to be totally in one or another of the four perspectives or all the four at once. This is to be striven for in the spiritual unfoldment. Saivite meditations produce. Shankaran Vedanta is the Mulif perspective. Dualistic Saivasiddhanta is the Dimfi perspective. Accepting everything, gods, all life, the Charya Kriya path. The Shumif perspective is basically yoga. The Simnif perspective is where people ordinarily are when not in Vedanta or Siddhanta. To psychoanalyze your problems would be in the Mulif perspective. To take them to the feet of Lord Murugan would be the Dimfi perspective. To move awareness away from the problem into a happier state of mind and then look back and understand the karmas involved is the Shumif perspective. To be injected by a psychiatrist with a chemical drug to alleviate the problem would be the Simnif perspective. So that's a very interesting statement worth commenting on. So, for example, let's say we're depressed. It's a typical problem. How do we handle our depression? Well, in religious approach, we would come to the temple and pray and try and be uplifted. That's the religious perspective, which Gurudeva calls Dimfi. So we take our problem to the feet of the deity and hope the deity will take it away. The other approach is meditation, which is related. So we look at depression as an area of the mind that we're stuck in, and we find a way through meditation to move our awareness to another area of the mind that isn't depressed. That's the meditative approach to solving the problem of depression. Then there's the problem of the way of talking it over, psychoanalysis. We talk it over with someone.